Department of Justice declared that human trafficking is a serious and growing problem in the United States, and many of the cases under investigation involve children. Many of those who are trafficked in the U.S. are victims of commercial sexual exploitation, including children and adults. So if you think that sex trafficking, even sex slavery, is a problem in another faraway country, well, think again. Today in Radio Times, we're going to look at trafficking and prostitution in the United States and here in Philadelphia. Who are the victims and how can they be helped? Who are the perpetrators? How can this crime be prevented? And a question that we've been thinking about at Radio Times, what role do those sex ads in the back of weekly newspapers play? We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios, and let me introduce them to you. Rachel Lloyd is the founder and executive director of GEMS. That stands for Girls Education and Mentoring Services. Also author of a book called Girls Like Us. It's out in paperback, I should say, about her own experience with commercial sexual exploitation and about some of the girls and young women she has been working with here in the United States. And Rachel Lloyd, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Donna Sabella. She's a mental health nurse, a faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She's the former program director and a founding member of Dawn's Place. That's a recovery program for trafficked and prostituted women in Philadelphia. And she's also the contributor editor of the American Journal of Nursing's Mental Health Matters column. And Donna Sabella, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
And our third guest is Mary DeFusco. She's the director of training and recruitment for the Defender Association of Philadelphia, also a founding board member of Dawn's Place. And she helped to establish Project Dawn Court, which is a prostitution intervention court. And Mary, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be back.
Nice to have all three of you here. And Rachel, if I could begin with you. And I read your book yesterday. You have an important and searing story to tell, I have to say. You write about your own life, the fact that you grew up in a chaotic family, you had an alcoholic and violent father, your mother had her own problems, you ran away from home, you dropped out of school. Do you think your story is helps us understand the story of other girls and women that get caught up in this kind of sexual exploitation?
Yeah, I mean, when I was initially writing the book, I actually didn't want to write a memoir. I wanted to do a very academic, polemic-y book, but realized, right, for folks to really understand this issue, because people really don't, that maybe my story could use as kind of a gateway, maybe, into kind of the lives and stories of other women and girls, and right, because one story doesn't tell the whole story. But I do think that my experiences are very, very similar, whether it's alcoholism, whether it's substance abuse, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's sexual abuse. I mean, right, chaos in the home, trauma and abuse in the home, we know is a common risk factor for girls and women who end up in the sex industry.
And you describe yourself as a young girl, even a young teenager, feeling invisible, feeling as if people really didn't see who you were.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you grow up in a particularly a substance abusing household, and my mother was really struggling with alcoholism very, very much, and it became very easy to just kind of, right, disappear and not be noticed. And so then there are people who are noticing you, though, and those tend to be adult men who are paying all kinds of attention to you when you're a 13-year-old girl. And so you are craving that kind of attention.
You ended up in Germany working as a quote-unquote hostess at a bar, and that was really the beginning of this sexual commercial exploitation.
Yeah, I left England really kind of in search of a better life, and with the wisdom that a 17-year-old has, got a one-way ticket to Germany and didn't speak German, and so kind of got stuck in a foreign country with no money, nobody I knew out there. And ended up, after a few weeks of trying to get a waitressing job with not speaking German, ended up going into a bar and asking for a job. And they said, sure. And I changed the date on my passport and they made me older. And I learned very quickly that day that there was a lot more to it than selling drinks.
Indeed. Well, and you hooked up with a guy you call BJ. In the book.
Not his real name.
No, I understand.
I had to think, it's BJ.
But he becomes your pimp.
Yeah, and I mean, right, and I... that relationship, I mean, for me, was a very real relationship. I mean, that was my boyfriend. And his father, I mean, you know, now in kind of hindsight, right, his father had been a pimp. This was something he'd grown up witnessing. And so while he wasn't necessarily pimping when he met me, it wasn't very long before he was able to pick up some of the things that he'd learned growing up. And I was, right, dealing with the stuff that I'd learned growing up. So together, not a great combination.
No, but how did that work? I mean, how did you each, I guess, depend on each other?
He actually later got diagnosed with schizophrenia. And so now looking back, seeing, right, his substance abuse as his own kind of self-medication. I was self-medicating because of all the trauma and the fact that I was having to go to work in a strip club every night. And very quickly it became about, you need to give me money. And this isn't a choice. And so if I didn't turn over the money, I mean, there was a lot of violence. I mean, an incredible amount of violence. I mean, it was very... I mean, there's a couple of stories I tell in the book where, right, I mean, torture-y kind of stuff, yes. Right? I mean, he was very kind of methodical about his violence, I guess is the best word. And so that bond becomes incredibly strong, and the loyalty was really there, and the fear was absolutely there, and that feeling of, like, this person has full control over my life. And you know, I mean, I talk in the book, when somebody has the power to take your life and doesn't, right, and you've had those, like, moments of near death, the feeling that you have is ultimately gratitude. And it creates just this very, very intense bond.
Well, it sounds like someone who's been in captivity and the kind of Stockholm syndrome that can develop where they develop almost a fondness, a relationship with their captor.
Absolutely. And I mean, I talk about Stockholm syndrome in the book and write how easy it is for us to get it when it's like Elizabeth Smart or Sean Hornbeck or J.C. Duggett, and how incredibly hard it is for us to get it when it's a girl or woman who's American or a low-income girl or a girl who's in the sex industry, right? And that we see it very, very differently. We see it as, oh, she must just want to stay.
Well, you also describe, and I think you just alluded to this, that there were moments of kindness and tenderness, which I guess also cements this kind of relationship, but also makes it confusing and perhaps even hard to leave.
Yeah, and I think in any, right, even domestic violence relationships, any kind of abusive relationship or situation, it's rarely all, every single waking moment bad, right? That you have to eat with somebody, you have to go to the bathroom, right? Like, there are moments of just mundane, normal day-to-dayness. And within that, there's moments of humanity and kindness and interaction and compassion. And so that's the stuff that keeps you locked down. Do you know what I mean? If you just keep somebody chained up all day, that person begins to figure, right? You begin to figure out how you're going to get out. But when you keep somebody locked up, but then you let them out for an hour, and then you're kind to them, and then you're nice to them, and right, that's how you really keep control over people.
Did you fear your pimp more than your John's?
Yeah. I mean, there were definitely some crazy Johns, but right, I worked indoors and so had relative safety in that, but my pimp was, I mean, he was schizophrenic, right? He was not a well person. He was insane.
Well, and it also sounds like, and I do want to get our other two guests in on the conversation, but that when you finally did leave, it sounded as if it was either he was going to kill you or you were going to kill him. I mean, it seemed like you were at the absolute, you know, bottom of the abyss in terms of imagining your life.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, I mean, he had tried to kill me on multiple occasions. I actually wrote last year about going to buy a gun, and wrote it because there's a young woman who's in prison in California who was 16 when she killed her 33-year-old pimp who's serving life without the possibility of parole. And so, right, seeing her story and thinking, God, that so easily could have been me if, right, the guy had shown up with the gun on time. And right, when I think back on kind of how that worked, I didn't have a particularly great plan around that, but it did feel like, right, and I mean, that's the reality for many women who end up killing abusive men, right? If you're in that moment where you feel like it's me or you, and yeah, I mean, it was more likely to be me though in that situation.
And you escaped. I mean, you got away.
And by the grace of God, yes.
And I do want to get back to all that. But Don, if I can turn to you and just from the work that you have been doing, I'm curious what you how you respond to Rachel's story. If it has sort of familiar ring to you and even some themes.
It does indeed. I mean, a lot of what Rachel's saying, as she pointed out, her story isn't every woman's story.
No.
But on the other hand, there's a lot of universality across the board in this. And in my work as a mental health nurse working with women, you know, we look at each individual case. But there is. And there are instances where women are perfectly, you know, they're educated, they come from good families, so they don't have those risk factors. And it happens for a number of different reasons. But certainly as young girls and kids and you know, with a lot of the risk factors, et cetera, that she mentioned, you know, we can sort of look for that and expect that. What is, though, for me, cause for concern
sure.
is that, you know, there are not a lot of treatment facilities. There's not a lot of people who are trained to work in this area. And there, sometimes people's misperception is that, you know, they really like the sex. The whole point of this is to get as much money as you can without having to do anything sexual with people, with the Johns. And, you know, Rachel spoke of sort of wanting to get out. A number of the women I've worked with also will be abused, will be raped. Statistics show that your chance of dying sooner than, you know, non-sex working population is 40% higher. The women I've worked with who've been molested, raped, that one woman had her eyes super glued shut, stab wounds, one guy ran over her multiple times with a car, is that, well, I asked for it. I mean, they come to believe that themselves. So a number of women would just get up, wouldn't file a police report, and then would get right back on the corner or right back to work feeling, you know, this is what I get.
And I want to get back to that. Mary, let me get you in on the conversation. And language is important when talking about what we're talking about. Absolutely. And the language that we're using is commercial sexual exploitation. Why is that significant?
Well, that's an umbrella term, first off, and it covers a lot of area. It covers trafficking, foreign trafficking, which thankfully everybody realizes is a problem, sex trafficking, that is. But it also covers domestic prostitution. It covers, you know, stripping. It covers any kind of activity where a person is essentially forced into it, can't find a way out of it. And I'm so grateful when I read Rachel's book, I was so grateful that she told us her story.
Yes.
Because that you could really see it. You could see inside how this could happen to a person. And I've seen it so many times with my clients over the years, over and over again. And then the world just looks at them and says, well, she's on the corner by herself. She must be a free agent. She must be doing it for the money. She must like the sex. Maybe she has a drug problem. That's the best you get out of the world at large. And the underlying abuse is never seen and therefore never treated.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about commercial sexual exploitation, domestic prostitution. We have three guests, Rachel Lloyd with us here in our Philadelphia studios, Mary DeFusco, the voice you just heard, and Donna Sabella. We're going to take a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Keystone Honors Academy at Cheney University supports WHYY. The Keystone Honors Academy offers competitive academic scholarships to undergraduate students, lessening the burden of attaining a quality college education. The Keystone Honors Scholarship provides eligible students with tuition, laptop, room, board, and fees, as well as a living learning community that nurtures growth and development. To learn more, 610-399-2386 or cheney.edu.
I'm Jesse Thorne, and there's some stuff that if you don't know about it, you really should.
My friend, we are going to be talking about Lucha Libre, a.k.a. Mexican wrestling, a.k.a. awesomeness. They really stay in character. The most legendary wrestler of all time, El Santo, there's reportedly only one photograph of him in existence without the mask on.
Josh Clark and Chuck Bryan from the podcast Stuff You Should Know on Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, enter to win a supporter-level membership to the Barnes Foundation. Visit Facebook.com/Newsworks and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. Like NewsWorks on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of rules, go to newsworks.org. Newsworks.org, powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Sex trafficking doesn't just happen in other countries. In fact, it's a problem here in the United States. The FBI says that an estimated 100,000 children are trafficked for sex in all states. Adults are trafficked as well. We're talking with Rachel Lloyd, a victim of commercial sexual exploitation, is founder of GEMS, Girls Education and Mentoring Services, also wrote a book called Girls Like Us. Mary DeFusco helped to found Project Dawn Court here in Philadelphia, and Donna Sabella is a founding member of a recovery program called Dawn's Place, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Rachel, let me go back to you, and one of the things that you write in your book is that you and, I guess, other girls like you, in the situation you were in, crave real relationships with their families, particularly with their mothers. That seemed to be a theme that you certainly lived in your life, but with some of the girls and young women that you've worked with, you see this as well. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, my own relationship with my mother was pretty challenged, particularly because of the alcoholism and her own history of trauma and abuse and what she couldn't kind of get past. With the girls and young women that I serve, this is just overwhelmingly an issue. I mean, it comes up all the time, and that disappointment of not feeling like mom is going to choose me over the drugs, or mom is going to choose me over the man, or mom is going to pay attention to me. And so the challenge in recovery and our work with young women is really, I mean, and we're talking about, right, particularly for teenage girls who just, right, hate their moms but love their moms so intensely and want that approval, is really to teach girls, you know, to develop a sense of resilience around that, and that mom may never change, and mom has her own stuff that she may not get through. But here's your community of people who really love you and support you. And it's not the same as family, but I think ultimately what we've created at GEMS is a surrogate family. And so, right, that becomes the place where you go and you get that validation and that love and support. And then you go home and mom says mean things, right? Yeah. I mean, and you have to learn how to distance yourself a little bit. I mean, that's for many of us, despite our experiences, right? Learning how to create healthy boundaries with our parents, that we love them, but maybe we don't let them hurt us in the same way or get in there into our hearts in the same way.
But it also sounds as if a part of the attraction was looking for a family or looking for someone that would love you and care for you and pay attention to you.
Absolutely. I mean, I this can happen to anyone, right? I mean, we know that, you know, sexual exploitation, ending up in the sex industry, can happen to anyone. Disproportionately, overwhelmingly, it happens to girls and women who have trauma in the family, who felt invisible, who felt neglected, who felt abandoned, and who were craving that sense of bond and connection and love. This is what essentially this boils down to, right? Wanting to be loved. Mm-hmm. And so the needs that girls have, it's not about needing designer clothes, right? And sometimes that's what the media will paint as, or needing to have sex. It's absolutely not about that in any way, shape, or form. But it is about needing love, which is a normal, common human need. But it just gets met in this really, really messed up and distorted and violent way.
Well, and just even your description of your relationship with your, you know, your boyfriend slash pimp, which was, there were these, you know, moments of calm and sounds like almost a reasonable looking relationship, mm-hmm. and then these explosions of violence and threat and even fearing for your life.
Yeah, and right, I mean, I think if for anyone who's been in an abusive relationship, right, those periods of calm get shorter and shorter, and the periods of violence get longer and longer until, but you keep holding out for those like few intermittent periods of calm and when things were good. And that's what keeps you kind of stuck.
How much is, we're talking about prostitution, we're also talking about sexual commercial exploitation, Mary. How common is that in a city like Philadelphia? Is there any way to know?
I sometimes think it's like an ocean. So many women trapped in it. I mean, just looking at the numbers of women at the prison, for instance, The largest population of women at the prison for nonviolent offenses is drugs, of course. The second largest is always prostitution. Hmm. And the prison has made strides in attempting to empty the prison. The numbers are going down. But nonetheless, it's always the second largest block of women. And you don't go to jail when you're arrested the first or the second or even the third time for prostitution. You have to continually be arrested. You have to continually be violating probation. And yet, still, it's such a large percentage of the population up at the prison.
And Donna, what's the connection between drugs and prostitution? Is there one?
There certainly can be for many people. Again, one of my great mentors, Kathleen Mitchell in Phoenix, got involved in prostitution had a pimp who would not let them use drugs at all. So there was never any drug history with Kathleen. But there certainly is a connection. As we know, many women go into sex work, prostitution, trafficking, because they have issues. They need to get money for drugs and housing, survival sort of things. There's also, though, the connection that once I'm involved in this, being forced to do this, to keep doing it at some point, many women then will turn to using drugs to numb themselves, to get through it.
Did you see that as well, Rachel?
Yeah, I mean, in my own experience, I mean, I've been drinking pretty heavily since I was about 12, 13. I mean, and that was dealing with my mother's stuff, and I was very much my mother's daughter in that respect. And then the drugs, right? I mean, I'd already been using some drugs. My pimp was using crack, which at that time, I didn't know what crack was. I just thought it was someone else you smoked. I mean, so.
Did you use crack?
Yeah, but he was actually, I mean, one of the few things I will say in gratitude to him is that he was very stingy about his crack. He didn't want me cracked out, and so he was actually very, very controlling about the amount of crack that he let me use, which in many respects probably saved my life and made my recovery much easier from at least that piece.
But did the drugs or maybe even the alcohol, did that help sort of numb the experience so that when you were out with your John, I mean, you could disappear, you could go someplace else?
Absolutely. And I think, right, what we know too, I mean, anywhere between 70 to 90% of both children and adult women who end up in the sex industry were sexually abused prior to recruitment into the sex industry. And so the ability to disassociate as a child who's experienced sexual abuse or sexual trauma works very well when you're in the sex industry. It's something you already know how to do, and that disassociation, then you throw in some drugs and alcohol. I mean, you can totally numb yourself in that respect.
And literally just mentally go somewhere else.
Yep, your brain is totally separated from your body.
You quote Andrea Dworkin in your book, and she says, incest is boot camp for prostitution. And I wrote that down for all the obvious reasons. Right?
Yeah, I mean, everything you're learning as a child who's experiencing child sexual abuse prepares you really, really well for being used in the sex industry.
Last time you were on, Mary, you brought in a photograph that which will haunt me for the rest of my life, and it was a series of, looks like mugshots, of women in Philadelphia.
Were in Denver.
In Denver. But they had been arrested, I guess, for prostitution, and over time, you see this deterioration that is absolutely shocking. I mean, you see people on this page, in a sense, dying on this piece of paper. As you see, over time, each arrest, they look worse and worse and worse.
Yes. I've shown those photos to people who work with these women. I've showed them to judges, probation officers, and stuff. What I find most interesting is that the judges, the probation officers, police officers, are not surprised at seeing how terrible the women look after the third or fourth arrest. They're surprised, they're shocked at seeing the first photo, when her face, her eyes are clear, she's young, she's attractive, and there's no sign of a drug addiction or anything. So that's what's shocking. What's also, I find shocking, but it is good news, is that if you reach out to these women and you give them the help and the care they need, those faces reverse.
Wow.
They do. On Wednesday, we had a woman graduate from the Project Dawn Court, and in the back of my file, I keep their arrest photo. And I was flipping through the phone. She said, let me see that. And she grabbed it. And she said, can I keep this? I said, good, you can, so long as you remember that that's not you anymore. But she was so happy to see the progress that you could visually see in her face that she had made. And so, I blessed the police detective who collected those photos for us.
And Project Dawn Court, you've talked about this on Radio Times, but this is a prostitution intervention court in Philadelphia.
It is a prostitution intervention court. The idea is, you know, Philadelphia has the Philadelphia Treatment Court, which has been incredibly effective. It's been around 15 years. It's internationally known and renowned. And it uses a series of rewards and sanctions to change behavior. Well, we do the same thing, but we also put in sexual trauma recovery groups, therapy for sexual trauma. And so that's how we can get these, when we can get to the underlying issues behind the drug and alcohol treatment so that we can make a permanent change in behavior.
And that's Mary DeFusco. She's Director of Training and Recruitment for the Defender Association in Philadelphia, just talking about Project Dawn Court, something that she helped to establish. Also with us is Donna Sabella, a mental health nurse, faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania, and also the former program director, founding member of Dawn's Place, a recovery program for trafficked and prostituted women here in Philadelphia. And Rachel Lloyd is with us as well. She's the founder and executive director of GEMS, that stands for Girls Education and Mentoring Services, author of a book now out in paperback called Girls Like Us about her own experience with commercial sexual exploitation, and also stories about some of the girls and young women that she has worked with as well. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Donna, I'm interested in the kind of help, and I'll get back to Rachel, but the kind of help that you have found that these young women, I'm assuming we're largely talking about maybe girls, what they need after they have been part of this sexual exploitation. What do they need?
I think there are a number of things, that are necessary. I think, first, one of the biggest obstacles is allowing everybody, girls and adult women, and we don't want to forget, too, that boys and men are also involved in this as well. But, the numbers are higher for female victims, is that they are comfortable in talking about what happened to them. Because a lot of times, and I know in training nurses and others to work with victims, the first time I hear something terrible, people's jaws tend to drop, and then I'm going to stop telling my story. And I think to be able to hear what people have to say, the good, the bad, and the ugly, because a number of the women I've worked with have talked about the good things about this for them, what they gained from it, and for me to come along and minimize that. Mm-hmm. You know, what we try to do is kind of recognize, all right, this is what you got out of it. How can we turn that around and get you some of those same good feelings by doing something that's, you know, healthy for you and not illegal? I think that's certainly an issue. Some counseling. I think we take care of, first, anything physical. If you come with a number of physical, you know, STDs, et cetera. The mental health component of that takes a long period of time. And people need to feel safe. They need to work with people who are trained, who know what this is about. The literature represents that a number of victims have been hit upon by therapists. All right. I've had two women in particular who were in therapy, and the counselor then, you know, hit once a whore, they say, quote unquote, always a whore, was the mentality, which is outrageous. So, you know, they're very leery, making people feel comfortable. And then, of course, all of the other things. I see the women here in Philadelphia needing GEDs, needing a way to support themselves, needing to be connected to other things, needing, you know, case management, perhaps, and all of the variety of things. So it's a really a holistic approach. Housing is a big issue.
Sure. For people. And all these things are probably interconnected.
Yes, and I certainly think that it could certainly begin in the jail here. Now, at some point, I was doing groups. Mary and I were working together, and I was in there doing groups with women, whether they'd been charged or not with this. They just self-identified. So it got them to think about some things and some resources when they got on the outside. So hopefully maybe that can be started again.
Well, Rachel, there's a book full of honesty about your life, and also a lot of the young women, girls that you work with. But you also talk about the struggle of looking back at what had happened to you. You even use the word choice, you know, that trying to understand how you got into this situation and obviously how to deal with it and move on from there. Do you feel like you have resolve some of these things? Is this a lifelong
I would hope so. I'm 37 this month, at the end of this month, and I got out when I was 19. So if I haven't, yes. I mean, I think, look, there are moments, right, where people can still say hurtful things. The stigma and the judgment that people have can still rub me the wrong way sometimes. Mm-hmm. I have been incredibly, look, I was lucky and blessed to get out when I did, as relatively unscathed as I was, right? Life could have looked very, very different for me. I have been incredibly blessed to do this work and to have spent the last 15 years surrounded by the best, funniest, smartest women and girls that I could ever hope to meet. I have a lot of love in my life, and have lots of love that I give and lots of love that I get back in return, and have been fortunate to be able to use these experiences to empower other people on some level, and to illuminate this issue. So, right, it's not always an easy thing to be out there and regurgitating stuff that happened to you, like as a teenager, at some of the darkest moments in your life. But I feel like every time I'm kind of like, oh, okay, I'm kind of done with talking about this, and then we'll get a call or an email from a girl who's like, and then I read your book and it made me realize that I was a victim and I never thought I was a victim. Right. And those moments, really, really make it worth it. So,
well, people don't talk about this. They don't talk about sexual exploitation. It's hard to talk about sexual abuse within families, incest. I mean, these are, I won't say taboos, but they're difficult conversations to have.
I think they are absolutely taboos. I think people have a really tough time talking about this stuff. And right, if we were doing a better job talking about child sexual abuse, if we were doing a better job talking about gender-based violence, which is an absolute epidemic in our country that we need to take more seriously, if we were doing better around that, right, this continuum of gender-based violence and where sexual exploitation and trafficking falls on the continuum, we could begin to significantly dent that issue.
Mary, if I can go to you, what we're talking about, a crime as well, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
I guess who's the criminal in,
well, see,
in
that's,
this?
Well, that's interesting. That's why you gave me pause when you said that, because, you know, my clients are looked at as the criminals, the women. You know, they're the ones who get arrested. They're the ones who get charged with crimes. They do arrest Johns occasionally, very, very occasionally. The numbers aren't even close. And when you consider that in reality, in prostitution, the Johns greatly outnumber the women, what's going on here? So yeah, they're viewed as the criminals when in fact they are the victims. And I liken it to domestic violence. I say, you know, you understand that it's hard for a woman to get away from her abuser. In the case of domestic violence, do you understand that essentially you're looking at a pimp relationship, and just because money enters the picture somewhere else, that doesn't change it. You're looking at a victim here. And if you treat her like a criminal, it's no wonder you can't get a handle on changing prostitution.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but Donna, so how should quote-unquote prostitutes be dealt with?
Again, that's a big, broad question. There's a lot of different things, but I certainly think understanding, encouragement, no judgment, and giving each woman, each girl, what she needs to move beyond that. Is very, very important.
Go ahead.
And let's stop calling them prostitutes.
Well,
Amen. When we're talking about children, we're talking about sexually exploited, trafficked. It's something that's done to them. When we're talking about adult women, let's talk about adult women in the commercial sex industry, right? That leaves for a very, very broad range of experiences. But the word prostitute has such a stigma and stereotype attached to it. And it's right, shameful for many people. So let's move away from
Fair
that.
Enough. No, I saw your face. And I appreciate that admonition coming from you. Rachel Lloyd is our guest, along with Donna Sabella and Mary DeFusco. And we are talking about sex trafficking, sexual exploitation, children and adults. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
On the next Fresh Air, a tribute to the late John Updike. Some of his most popular titles are being re-released this week in honor of his birthday. Updike would have been 82. I was lucky enough to have interviewed him several times. We'll hear highlights of some of those interviews on the next Fresh Air. Join us. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Khaled M. is the Libyan-American rapper who penned an anthem for Libya's revolution, but only got to visit his family's home country after that revolution. We'll hear what that was like. Also, Our Night with actor Viggo Mortensen. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with three women today in this hour of Radio Times. Rachel Lloyd, the founder and executive director of GEMS, Girls Education and Mentoring Services, author of Girls Like Us, about her own experience with commercial sexual exploitation and her work with girls and young women. Donna Sabella, mental health nurse, faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, former program director and founding member of Dawn's Place. It's a recovery program for trafficked and prostituted women here in Philadelphia. And also with us is Mary DeFusco, the Director of Training and Recruitment for the Defender Association of Philadelphia, a founding board member of Dawn's Place, and also helped to establish Project Dawn Court, and that's, as she described it, a prostitution intervention court. We have just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Layla from Pottstown to join us. And Layla, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Marty. Hi, everyone. Thank you for doing this.
You're welcome.
I'm originally from Dearborn, Michigan, and I had an arranged marriage. I grew up a Lebanese American Muslim, and it was part of a family tradition to arrange our marriages. And about a month after I got out of college, a bachelor's degree in fine arts and English, hoping to be a teacher, I had an arranged marriage with a man that our families knew each other. After honeymoon in Lebanon, we ended up in Germany, interestingly enough. I was talking about Germany, because he supposedly had a job there. The first time we went to his home, which he supposedly bought for me, you know, there were other women in the house, and I said, oh, great, I've married a polygamist. This is horrible. Get me out of here. Well, it was worse than that. He had quote-unquote other wives, and he was using them as prostitutes, and shortly after he took my virginity, I became a prostitute as well. He would look in on all the sessions, as he called them, the clients were all very rich, high-end people. I was lucky. It was less than a year that I was in this situation. One of the Johns was a physician, and one day when my husband was out, because he came to trust me, he was out when I had a client. I told this doctor, I said, can you get me, like, morphine or something? I want to be drugged. I can't take this. He goes, you mean you don't want to be doing this? I said, no, my husband's forcing me to do this. And he never touched me anymore after that, but he came to visit me every week, and he did give me drugs, and he told me how to take them. And then about 4 weeks later, he said, my conscience is bothering me. I have to get you out of here. There's going to be a client that's going to come to see you tomorrow, and he told me his name. And you're going to go with him to his house. I'm going to arrange it with your husband, but I'm going to get you to the American embassy. And he did.
And
this guy came, Marco. I'll never forget him, like an angel. And we got in his limousine. He took me straight to the American embassy, and I got myself home. The husband was... eventually, he was arrested, and he went to prison, not for a very long time, but leaving prison, actually, he was killed by one of the parents of the other girls.
Oh, my goodness.
Of course, I came home and could never go back to my family because they would have killed me because I was defiled. So I had to basically go out on my own, and I moved to Houston, Texas, and tried to go back to graduate school, but I couldn't. So I just had a series of jobs, and eventually got a lot of therapy, and I've had jobs, but but PTSD definitely is my diagnosis.
Sure.
But wonderfully enough, I am in my 40s now, so this happened a while ago. By the way, my ex-husband had me sterilized during that time, so I never could have children, but I just met a wonderful man who in Pennsylvania, and we'd gotten married, and he accepts me for who I am, and life is beginning again.
Well, Layla, first of all, I thank you so much for calling in. It was very brave of you to tell this story. We're all looking at each other with tears in our eyes because of what you have endured. So hold on just one second. And Rachel, I'm looking at you. You're also pained, as we all are, listening to Layla's story.
Heartbreaking. Layla, I am so, so sorry that that happened to you. And just reaching out over the radio with us, all of us, with as much love and respect and compassion for your journey and your recovery. Mm-hmm. And right, there's obviously still a lot of pain there, but it's good to hear that, right, that you've found love and that you're rebuilding. But I know, like, right, that there's obviously still a lot of pain, and I just encourage you to kind of get ongoing support and talk about it, and you have nothing to be ashamed of, and you have nothing, right? This wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault.
Took a long time to realize that.
Yes. And you don't, and can I just say too, I've heard other women do this, and I've done this in my own life. You don't have to minimize, right? Like, oh, it wasn't that bad. It was only a year, right? It was your life, and it was awful, and pain is relative. And so don't feel like you ever have to minimize or rationalize, like, well, it wasn't as bad as this person or that person, right? What happened to you was horrific, and it should never have ever happened to you. And I just wanted to say that, because I think we tend to do that, and we hear other people's stories, and we're like, oh, it wasn't as bad, like, right, it happened to you, and it was horrible, and you, it's okay to own that, and it's okay to know that.
And Layla, you did an important and a very brave thing this morning on the radio. Let me give our other guests a chance to weigh in. Go ahead, Donna.
Layla, I share and echo Rachel's comments to you, and I think the beauty of, I admire your courage, and people listening in this morning now have a better understanding of the depth of the trauma that is involved with something like this, of what people feel, and hearing your heartfelt story, I think will change the dynamics for a lot of the listeners. So thank you very much for that.
You want to add anything?
Yes, I just want to say thank you again, Layla. I knew how much courage that took for you, and I'm in awe of your courage. And I just want to echo what everybody said. It's not your fault, honey. And you just the fact that you've done everything you've done, you've come through this, you're just an amazing, amazing, amazing woman. And I thank you again.
Okay. Thank you all for the program. Maybe I can help other women someday.
No, I think you did.
Yes.
I think you did. Thank you, Layla. Thanks for calling in. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Very emotional. But this is what you deal with, Rachel.
Yes. I mean, yes. And I don't, right? I mean, I'm working with girls and women all day, and I'm not normally sitting there crying all day because I couldn't get through the day. Right? It's just tough to hear just people's pain sometimes. Yeah. I mean, right? I mean, God bless her, and what courage. And, you know, I'm sure that there are a lot of women out there who were really encouraged just by her doing that. But, right, just the raw pain that sometimes, it's just, right, who deserves that? Who warrants Indeed. That? Who asks for that? No one, right? There's just some really bad stuff that happens in our world. And sometimes it can, right? It's painful to listen to.
Yeah. Layla, thanks for calling in. Donna, if I can go to you, and we've been focusing on girls and women, but you had mentioned the fact that, and we should not ignore the fact that when talking about sexual exploitation, boys and men can be involved in that as well, as victims.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's the same, the area overlaps with domestic violence as well. Men and boys are a population that tend to be left out of the mix, even in things like domestic violence. Very few treatment programs for boys and men. So we do need to keep in mind, and I think, you know, something that could be worked on is offering, because it is a bit different.
Right. The dynamic
is a little different. The recovery, you know, how people feel about this, what happens, some of the needs are a bit different from women. Again, there is that connection, there's similarity, but there are some differences as well.
Yeah, you want to add to that, Mary?
Anything? Yeah, I think there definitely are differences. And actually, I really make no apology for focusing on women here, because, you know, my background is criminal justice, and everything in criminal justice is geared to men, from the way drug and alcohol treatment is done. It's all geared for men. And the reason is because men predominate in criminal justice. Mm-hmm. Well, when you come to the field of commercial sexual exploitation, women predominate by far. So under those circumstances, I think it's important to focus on the women, not to ignore the men, but as Donna says, it is a slightly different issue, and I think it's important that we put our focus here on what's been a problem all along but invisible to most people.
And not to get political here, but as we are talking about sexual exploitation, I was thinking of Rush Limbaugh's comments calling this college student, a law school student, a slut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is different for women. It is, we grow up being treated differently. The issues around sexuality are different.
But a slut for wanting contraception.
Birth control. Yes. I mean, and right, that's, I mean, let's not get started on the topic, but right, just looking at the world that women and girls grow up in and the challenges of, right, wanting to take care of your health, but then being viewed as a slut, having sex and being viewed, right? I mean, all of those things, and then, right, you end up in the commercial sex industry, and then you wonder why women have so much shame and stigma around this and why we're seen as, like, pariahs in society, right? I mean, and how hard it is for folks like me or my girls or Layla or someone to heal from that over time, and how much you need to be around other women and girls who've had those experiences. It's absolutely critical that survivors have other survivors to talk to and look up to and, right, and see that there's hope and healing.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Stephanie from University City. And Stephanie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just had a question. I work in social services, and I work with youth who are transitioning out of foster care. Mm-hmm. And I have heard many stories from them about being involved in prostitution, and it's kind of mixed about how they get involved. I'm not always sure, but I wonder if any of your guests have any type of information about how many youth who are in the foster care system do end up in prostitution, and also if they're, how we can get in contact with them so that, perhaps programs like GEM could come out to speak to youth at other organizations.
Stephanie, it's a very good question, and I'm looking at you, Donna Sabella. Go ahead.
I think that we know that foster care increases the risk factor to begin with, because there's other things going on before a child gets to that point. So right away, there's a correlation between being in foster care. And I think that, the prostitution, the commercial sexual exploitation, can occur anywhere from something as simple as, I want some designer jeans. I taught high school, and that was an issue that we were looking at, kids from the suburbs. It's happening in movie theaters. It's out there simply because they want, to have money to do some of these things. And it runs the whole continuum to children who are already, subjected to incest, abuse, et cetera, and who are runaways. That's a common factor, too. And I know Covenant House here in Philadelphia does some work with children and goes out, called Survival Sex. So I would know if I were, a hawk, or if I were looking to pick up kids. Bus station's good. The mall's good. Rachel said earlier, kids and all of us want to be loved. And that was a main theme through all of this. So if I'm looking to scout some, young people, I'm going to go to the mall or the bus stations and talk up how much, you deserve to be treated well, I love you, et cetera.
You want to add to that, Mary?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think a lot of times we lose sight of the fact when we look at adults that they, they were children, and they got into this, if you want to call it a line of work, as children. And many times we don't see the root. And as a result, we're not able to deal with the problem. We're not able to provide the treatment that we need. I think it's really important. I think it's why Rachel's book is so eye-opening, because she really shows you the continuum of how we get from a small child to an adult.
Let me get one more caller before I have to say goodbye. This is Grace from Doylestown. And Grace, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I wanted to ask your callers about what they thought of the media sort of glorifying high-class hookers in different shows. Like in the West Wing, there was a person in law school who was a high-class prostitute, or there's a show on Showtime about the same thing. And I wanted to know how they thought that affected people who are forced into this.
Grace, I'm going to toss that to Rachel Lloyd because she writes about it in her book.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the media's depiction of the commercial sex industry is just way off, period. I think we like, and look, I mean, we don't use the term hooker, but I think we, those images of kind of that, quote, okay, I'm on the radio, so I can't do air quotes, the high class escorts, and this idea that it's that pretty woman thing and that girls are just, and women are just paying their way through college and having a great time. Look, there may be, there, I am never going to argue that there are adult women who are college educated, who have options, who weren't abused, who end up in the commercial sex industry, and for whom this does not feel disempowering or exploitive or violent. Those women are in the very, very tiny minority, and they're not the women who the commercial sex industry makes its money off of, right? It's a $1 billion industry, and it's not making its money off of white middle-class women who are working in high-class escort agencies. It's making its money off the backs of drug-addicted women on the streets of Philadelphia. It's making its money off the backs of children in Calcutta, unemployed women desperate in the Ukraine, girls who've been in the foster care system in New York. And so those depictions, whilst glamorous and titillating to the viewer, right, are just not representative of the millions of women and girls around the world for whom the sex industry is not about choice, but it's about lack of choices.
Well, we could go on, but the clock is telling me that we do need to end our hour. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. And Rachel Lloyd, especially to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And her book is called Girls Like Us, and it's about her own experiences in the commercial sex industry or with commercial sexual exploitation, and also stories about the girls and young women that she works with at her organization called GEMS, Girls Education and Mentoring Services. Also with us is Donna Sabella, a mental health nurse, faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, and a founding member of Dawn's Place, a recovery program for trafficked and prostituted women here in Philadelphia. Also Mary DeFusco, the director of training and recruitment for the Defender Association of Philadelphia, and she helped to establish Project Dawn Court in Philadelphia, a prostitution intervention court. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Emily Bryant, our intern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And if you